And right now it's time for Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm really delighted to be bringing you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll be speaking with Dr. Temple Grandin about her new best-selling book about an array of animal behavior, perhaps about autism as well. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune. This is Miles Davis with his version of Bye Bye Blackbird here on Talking Animals. This is Miles Davis, of course, with his version of Bye Bye Blackbird, an animal tune of sorts, as we ease into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name is Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. For more information about the show and past guests, as well as archives and iTunes podcasts, I invite you to visit our website, talkinganimals.net. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Dr. Temple Grandin, an internationally renowned expert on both animal behavior and autism. She herself is autistic. Professor at Colorado State University, Dr. Grandin is also a best-selling author, most recently, of Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. We'll discuss some of the fascinating, at times surprising, information presented in her new book, and surely other topics, possibly including autism, when we speak with Dr. Temple Grandin in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. First, though, as always, we try to hit a couple of quick animal news items and or announcements. So in conjunction with Spay Day USA, the Animal Coalition of Tampa is hosting Tampa's first neuterathon in the ACT Spay Neuter Clinic on February 21st and 22nd. Cost? We can't really say, but it's somewhere between $4 and $6. Limited to male cats only. Price includes surgery, pain injection, and a rabies shot. Advanced registration is required by calling 1-888-SPAY-FLA, 888-772-9352. And Florida Voices for Animals is coming right up on their annual Have a Heart fundraising dinner with, as always, an amazing guest speaker. The dinner will be held February 15th, starting at 4:30 in the afternoon, and the speaker will be Colleen Patrick Goudreau, founder of Compassionate Cooks. More information at floridavoicesforanimals.org. All right, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Paul F. Tompkins with a piece called Alternative Pets on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
People who have their alternative pets on their person, people walking around with animals on their body. See a guy who's got an iguana hanging out up there on his shoulder? See another person with a crazy cockatiel just hanging out? And I guess you're supposed to have some reaction to these people, you know? I guess what they want you to say is something like, well, pardon me, sir. Is that a bird on your shoulder? Well, you must be one fascinating individual. Your personality is not at all manufactured. I say, what if we were to exchange addresses and became pen pals? That way I could collect your letters in a bound volume entitled, My Correspondence with the Most Interesting Person Alive. I'm working hard for you. That's great. You can have any animal that you want, you know, because we have dominion over the beasts of the fields and all, you know, but here's the thing. Even animals need some alone time, okay? How about that, you know? Maybe the lizard would like to sit at home, play on the rock for a while, you know? Maybe the bird would like to play with the bell, look in the mirror for a little bit. Maybe they don't have to come with you on all your jackass errands. How about that? Leave them alone for a minute. Come on, Cecil, we're going down to the bank so everybody can see your crazy eyes. Woo!
All right. That was Paul F. Tompkins with a piece called Alternative Pets, taken from a Comedy Central set. I'm Duncan Strauss's Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net, where not only all our past programs our archive, but most are available as podcasts in iTunes. For example, our show last week with Pretenders leader and animal activist Chrissy Hynde. We also have a link to the Talking Animals MySpace. We're looking for friends, our Facebook page. We're looking for fans, and our blog. There's also a place to subscribe to our email newsletter so we can keep you posted on forthcoming guests, programming news, and more. That's all at talkinganimals.net. It's just about time to speak with today's guest, Dr. Temple Grandin, so let me outline a few details about her. As I touched on a moment ago, Dr. Grandin is an internationally renowned expert on both animal behavior and autism. She herself is autistic. Much of her work is rooted in her thesis that animals and autistic people share some fundamental traits, including that they're considerably more sensory-based visual thinkers than verbal ones. This is figured into, for instance, her pioneering work designing more humane mechanisms and practices for slaughter plants. A professor at Colorado State University, Dr. Grandin is also a best-selling author, most recently, of Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. There's considerable ground to cover here, so with a reminder that we invite you to enjoy the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Dr. Temple Grandin back to the program. Are you there, Dr. Grandin?
I'm right here.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. And, boy, this new book, like all your books, is just chock full of fascinating and often surprising information about all types of animals, ranging from the ones that live with us, cats and dogs, to the ones like cows and pigs and chickens, the sort of wildlife, and a section on zoos. And I guess it would be sort of inaccurate to say this is an animal rights show. By design, we sort of pursue a much broader agenda, but we certainly spend some time discussing animal rights issues. So I'd like to start today's conversation with a related point in the book I was really struck by. You note there's often an unintended consequence when animal rights organizations try to change things by passing laws and filing lawsuits. And sort of by way of example, can you talk a bit about the situation with the Humane Society and horse slaughter?
Well, that's been a real mess, and that's something that's very well intentioned, because maybe in an ideal world we wouldn't have horse slaughter plants. But the problem is when you suddenly shut the plants down, you've got a lot of horses going down to Mexico, a lot of horses getting abandoned. A better way to have gotten rid of horse slaughter plants would be to make them obsolete. You know, just like animal shelters now are killing less cats and dogs because you've got good spay and neuter programs. You know, what you want to do is try to get rid of the need for horse slaughter plants. You know, this is something where it was very well intended, but it's been a very, very bad consequence. I mean, thousands of horses have gone down to Mexico and been killed in the most barbaric manner possible, stabbing them in the back of the head with a knife.
So, I guess in retrospect, what could or should have been done differently there, in your view?
Well, one of the things that should be done would be to, you know, reduce the need for the horse slaughter plants.
You know, how do we do that?
Well, let's look at indiscriminate breeding. One of the things that has been researched is how many horses are being bred just indiscriminately in people's backyards. I mean, that's a big problem with cats and dogs too, and that's been reduced a whole lot, because I've been really pleased to. You know, I've visited some shelters around different cities, and the adoption rates are going way up, and spay and neuter programs have, you know, cut down a lot of surplus cats and dogs. And you know, just breeding horses, you know, sort of willy-nilly, nobody really knows how much of that's going on. I mean, that'd be a first step to do.
Mm-hmm. And, okay, but I guess just more on a sort of fundamental level in terms of the thing that you had noted about the unintended consequence. Because
well,
obviously
all I
people
can
were
say
well-meaning.
A lot of issues.
Yeah.
Is that people that make policy, I don't care what government policy or whether whatever kind of policy it is, need to find out what's going on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen on the ground when they implement that policy? And one of the things we need in a lot of issues is, you know, people working on the ground, you know, that can, so we can make policies that actually are going to work. And we're getting more and more what I call abstractification. You know, like, who's going to be the next Jane Goodall?
Yeah, well, that's certainly something you raise in your book that I wanted to get to as well. Well, I guess along the same lines then, since just one of the things you're saying is, like, look a couple of steps ahead for passing laws or filing lawsuits. A case that many of us are following closely is the federal lawsuit brought by several animal groups against Ringling Brothers for its, you know, the alleged and not so alleged endemic abuse of the elephants under the endangered species.
I do not have enough information to make a comment about that.
Okay. All right. Because I was just going to see if you...
I don't have enough information.
Okay.
I don't comment on things that I don't have enough knowledge to make comment about that.
Okay. And sort of at another point in the book along these, I guess, sort of same lines, closing actually the section on wildlife, you observe you can't pass laws against human nature if you do the animals will suffer. Can you sort of elaborate?
In wildlife, we've got to work on programs to make wildlife valuable to the local people. And in the wildlife section, to talk about a program in Mongolia on protecting the predatory animals by helping the farmers build corrals and working with the local people. Also, tourism and things like that can make the animals valuable. But the problem is, if I'm somebody who lives in Africa, I'm just a poor farmer, and the elephants come in and eat my entire crop, my family's food is gone. I'm not going to be very happy about that, and it's not going to make me like elephants. We've got to do things that are sustainable that will make those animals, valued by the locals rather than something that just wrecks their crops.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I gotcha. Let me just let our listeners know, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Dr. Temple Grandin, whose new book is Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Dr. Grandin a question, please call 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. So, Dr. Grandin, at the risk of sort of having the conversation seem a bit scattered, I'm just inclined to skip around the book just in hopes of offering even a representative slice of Animals Make Us Human. The stuff we've touched on so far was sort of toward the back of the book. Let's jump to the front. For people thinking about getting a dog, what are the most important factors to consider? Because, again, I feel like
a lot of the things that's a big theme in the book is the animal emotional systems, the brain basic emotional systems of fear, rage, separation, anxiety, seeking, play, it's very important to provide environments where an animal can play, where an animal has companions. That's extremely important. And if you're getting a pet, you need to think about, if you live in an apartment and you work for 10 hours a day, a large active dog is going to have separation anxiety and you have a really bad time being in your apartment. Maybe a cat might be a more appropriate pet. And I think the animal shelters are getting better and better at helping people to, pick out an appropriate pet. And, they behavior test animals and, get an animal that's the right animal for you. And
sure.
Dogs are going to require a lot more work than cats, especially now with all the leash laws. You're going to need to spend an hour a day with your dog to really give it a good quality of life.
Right. Well, and in the animal world, I think many find Cesar Millan kind of a polarizing figure. And I found your view of his work and theories really kind of intriguing. Can I ask you to sort of outline where his principles do and don't sort of dovetail with yours?
I went out and bought 2 years of his episodes and watched them.
Okay.
And I divided them into successful, so-so, and bad. And the bad episodes were the animals of fear. The animal is afraid of the scissors, afraid of the toaster. Caesar just shoves the poor dog into it, and it was snarling through the whole entire episode. That was just awful.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know how to deal with fear. The separation anxiety cases, he doesn't know what to do with. But when you get, say, you have a Rottweiler that's challenged the owner and has growled or maybe bitten the owner, that's where Caesar really works. And I just got a thing from the American Veterinary Animal Behavior Society today, press release, on the whole dominance theory. Now, this was going into some methods that are a whole lot rougher than what Caesar's doing, and methods I think are absolutely totally bad.
Yeah.
But one thing that Caesar does very well is that sort of confident. I mean, he can walk into a, a Rottweiler that's full of teeth that nobody else is going to walk into, and animals pick up on that body language and that confidence. And there's certain kinds of dogs where I think Caesar's been brilliant, but if the emotional driver is separation anxiety, which is panic, or fear, he's terrible.
Hmm. Yeah. So those stacks must have been pretty interesting when you got through going through them all, and good, bad, as you completed your viewing there of his episodes. But interesting. Well, Dr. Grandin, not surprising, we have some callers and some emailers. Let's take a call if you like. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Temple Grandin.
Hi, this is Jacqueline from Tampa.
Hi, Jacqueline. A question for Dr. Grandin?
Yeah, actually, two comments first. Thank you for the comments on Caesar and working with fearful animals. Some of those episodes absolutely just make me cry.
Oh, they were awful. That episode with the scissors and the poor little dog is just, poor little dog's just snarling the whole time. That was absolutely awful.
I was crying so hard on that episode. And I am actually a professional trainer and behavior consultant for animals, so, I mean, that broke my heart.
Oh, it was awful. That was a horrid episode. But then there were some other large, rather aggressive dogs where he was brilliant. You see, the people want to make one size fit all, and it doesn't. We've got to go back to those core emotional systems and go, what is motivating that behavior?
Right. So thank you for saying that. And then the other comment, I just am not sure if you were aware that some of the newer studies on gaze and points with animals, because in the book you list that dogs are capable of doing that, but wolves are not. And newer studies have shown that wolves are capable of it, and cats are as well.
Yes, and I'm aware of those studies, and unfortunately the book had been sent to the printers, but, there's a
big
leap.
Deadlines are deadlines.
Okay, I was wondering about that. And then my real question that I had for you is that I would like to know more on the perspective of how you wrote some things in the book that are very concrete. So very cats will do this, but a dog would never do that. And so I wasn't sure, is that coming from from your autistic perspective?
Well, the thing
is, let
me explain about autism. Autism, I think in pictures. I think more like how an animal thinks. I think in pictures. I think in sounds. I don't think in words. My mind's like Google for images. If you give me a keyword, I start getting images. And also, in writing a, you're a professional dog trainer, and I'm trying to write a book that, somebody that knows nothing about animals. I mean, I just talked to a lady this morning that was going to get her first pet for her 9-year-old daughter and didn't know whether she'd get a cat or a dog. And when you're dealing with that audience, you've got to really simplify. And then for the professional like you, it's too simplified.
Okay.
Okay, thank
it.
You so much for your call.
Thank
We're going to move
you.
Along. Thank you. Hi, you're on WMNF with Talking Animals with Dr. Temple Grandin. Quick question, please.
Yes. My name is Yvette. I'm calling from Brandon.
Okay.
I was wondering for a first-time dog owner, we're planning on getting a dog. Would she recommend to get a dog from a shelter or from a breeder as far as, encountering too many problems if you get an adult dog from a shelter?
Well, there's a lot of good pets down at the shelter, and I always like to promote shelter pets. And, some of the purebreds have got some horrible medical problems. I mean, the bulldog, for example, they're getting the heads bigger and bigger and bigger. They have breathing problems. Get a friendly dog. Also, the shelters now are doing a better job at temperament testing animals and helping you choose an appropriate animal. And shelters are going to be very variable. I mean, some are better managed than others, and you need to ask around and find a real reputable place that's going to give you an appropriate dog, especially being, a first-time owner. Somebody that's a pro, they can take an animal that's got some issues, but the first-time owner, there's plenty of good dogs out there that don't have issues.
And if I may just thank you for your question, if I may just piggyback on that, adopt. So in the interest of achieving equal time of sorts, I guess I have some cat questions, Dr. Grandin. At one point in the book, you note that cats are less neotenized than other domestic animals. Can you kind of explain exactly what this means and the implications?
Well, neoteny is breeding for more juvenile characteristics. I mean, dogs retain a lot of puppy-like characteristics, like barking a lot. That's actually a puppy-like characteristic. So the sort of neediness, separation anxiety, that's a puppy-like characteristic. And we've bred dogs to do lots of different jobs, herding, guarding, and other jobs, hunting dogs. We haven't done that with cats. People just kept cats for pets, or they just kind of were around in the barn and catching mice, and they haven't been subjected to the same, breeding selection pressure. Nobody's worked to deliberately neotenize cats. Another reason why we haven't bred cats as much is dogs want to please. See, one of the advantages of a dog is he'll work for you just for praise and stroking.
Mm-hmm.
The cat you have to train with food motivation. And clicker training works great. And we've got quite a lot of stuff in Animals Make Us Human on clicker training.
Yeah, quite interesting, really, that they respond so well to clicker training. Yeah.
Oh, clicker training works great on cats. You can teach a cat to do a dog agility course with clicker training.
Wow. And, as I mentioned before, we're always urging folks to adopt animals. Maybe you could tell us the three things to do to wind up with a cat, adopting a cat ideally, with a friendly, bold temperament.
Yeah, you want to get a friendly cat. Most shelters now have got a room where you can sort of get to know the animal just, by itself. And there's some tips in the book on adopting cats. There are animals that have been abused that have issues, but somebody who's getting their first cat or their first dog, I'd recommend avoiding those. you know, the pros, the people that work, you know, that have a lot of experience, they can take a lot of those animals and rehabilitate them. But I think the woman that was getting a dog or a cat for a 9-year-old daughter needs to try to get one without issues.
Sure.
Also, you need an appropriate animal. If you live in an apartment, you don't want to get a high-energy, frisky lab that needs an hour of hard exercise every day. You might want to get a smaller dog or
sure.
get a dog that's sort of lazier.
Sure. Well, and we're going to get to some more calls momentarily here, but you know, one of the other things I found interesting in your guidelines for winding up adopting a cat with a friendly, bold temperament, number three was adopt a black cat, which I just thought was so interesting.
Well, the black cats tend to be calm. There's a show to work over in England that called blacks laid-back blacks, and torties were naughty torties. I found the marmalade cats are often, they startle really easy,
mm-hmm.
but are often very affectionate. I've known 3 or 4 marmalades, and that's the way they've been. There was one that lived at my apartment building, and all that cat wanted to be was stroked. And stroke your animal, don't pat it. They interpret patting as hitting.
Yeah, and well, it's very interesting because the most recent cats we adopted at our house were black, but that was largely because we've thought, and this has been confirmed by people on the show and elsewhere, that black cats are usually the last to be adopted. So anyway, I found that really
interesting. Well, a lot of nice cats. I mean, the important thing to do is to adopt an animal that has a good disposition.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that's the important thing, and
sure.
there's a lot of variation. I want to emphasize there's a huge, tremendous amount of variation.
Right.
There's going to be variation in black cats. I'm concerned about some of the animals that have, blue eyes, because if you breed two of those together, you're more likely to have neurological problems, deafness, problems like that. I'm very concerned about dog breeders just over-selecting for stupid appearance traits
sure.
and getting all kinds of skeletal problems, behavior problems, and medical problems. They need to work on correcting these things.
Sure.
They need to be breeding a sound animal with a sound, behavior and brain.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's take some more calls because sadly we're already sort of nearing the end of our time. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Temple Grand. A quick question, please.
Hello?
Go ahead, it's you. Quick question,
yeah, thanks,
please.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yes, my wife and I are both allergic to cats and dogs, pretty much. And I ask this question frequently and haven't really gotten a straight answer. Is there any possibility of finding a dog that is hypoallergenic?
Well, the poodle is a good choice. I have a friend that their kid's allergic to dogs, and they got a standard poodle. He's real high energy. They absolutely love him. I'm not going to say they're completely hyperallergenic, but lots of times the poodle, and I think when I was talking about Obama's dog, they had a choice between a poodle or the water dog, because those are two breeds that tend to not cause so many allergy problems. But I can't guarantee that he'll be no allergy problems.
Just sort of the best odds. Thanks very much for your call. Dr. Grannon, we are nearing the end of our time, but one of our emailers raised a good question that I sort of glossed over, and maybe you could just briefly explain. They're asking to hear more about clicker training.
Well, clicker training basically is a method that where you have a little clicker device in your hand, and you click the clicker, then you feed the ant. You click the clicker and feed the animal a treat, and you get the animal to associate that click with a treat. You click the clicker, then you give them the treat. And once he learns to associate that clicker with a treat, you can then shape behavior. Okay, let's say you want a dog to go through the agility course. If he just started facing the agility course, you'd give him a click. And, of course, the person who's the guru on that is Karen Pryor. She's got a video called Clicker Magic. The cat segment in there is just absolutely clicker magic. It's a fairly easy method to learn. In fact, Karen Pryor is going to be coming out with a new book really soon just on clicker training.
Well, that's great, and we're just in our remaining moments. I kind of want to widen out a little bit from our cats and dogs. Just because so much of the book and just obviously your work is about trying to make things better in the livestock world. Can you describe the reaction when you propose setting up cameras at plants to sort of monitor the livestock handling?
Well, I've worked with the plants on putting in auditing systems where you measure handling, and some plants fake good, when the auditor's there. But there's a few plants now that actually have video cameras put in, where an auditor over the internet can then watch what they're doing, and they never know when that auditor is going to be watching. And there's about 6 plants right now that have the system in, 5 in the U.S. and 1 up in Canada. Hopefully some of the big companies are going to adopt it. You know, when I first proposed this idea, that they just had a fit, but now the people are getting more and more, you know, accepting of it. Also putting cameras in for critical food safety parts of the plant, too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think even when you described the initial reaction, I think you said something like they thought I was off my rocker. So it sounds like they've come a long way from that. And a sort of similar point, really, which I really liked, was in the section on cows. At one point, you write, a dream of yours is electronic measurement of cattle handling, with automatic payroll deductions or bonuses. And how exactly would that work?
One of the big problems you have with stockmanship and handling is you get people get a better attitude. And if you can change people's attitudes towards handling gets better. But there's a tendency, if you don't constantly manage handling, and I'm referring to handling, okay, people that are vaccinating, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cattle or pigs, the handling has a tendency to get rough unless you keep measuring it. If you don't keep measuring it, well, then the electric prod gets brought out more and more and more, and I call it bad becoming normal. It slowly gets bad, just like the problem with the bulldog having all their problems. That slowly got bad. It slowly gets bad, and people don't realize it, so you've got to measure it. Well, you can get electronic devices now that could measure things like how fast cattle are running, cattle slamming into the chute too hard. That could be measured, And, you know, financial rewards really work. I mean, I found in my work years ago on preventing bruises, when people had to pay for them, they handled the cattle a whole lot better.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm tempted to gild a lily here. There's so many callers here. We're really kind of over our time, but let's take one more. I just ask, hi, you're on Talking Animals with Temple Grant. I just ask you to ask a very brief, succinct question, please.
Hello.
Hi, it's you. Quick question, please.
What's the best way to defuse a dog fight? I had the experience yesterday. 3 very large dogs.
Okay.
And they're right in the middle of a gigantic fight?
Yes.
I wouldn't put my hands in the middle of it, that's for sure. They're in the middle of a gigantic fight. If you get a water hose, you know, squirt the garden hose on them. But I don't want to...
Well, I had nothing in my hands, but, you know, I was doing a lot of yelling and waving. And,
well, yeah.
I'd break them up and
they'd
jump back in. But was I actually feeding it by trying to...
Well, sometimes yelling just... They interpret that as, oh, save me, save me. You see, like a dog on a leash and a dog off the leash, it's kind of two separate file folders, and he may feel he has to protect you when he's on the leash.
Right.
But some of the
worst
dogs for fighting are dogs that are not properly socialized. You know, we got more behavior problems now with all the leash laws than we had when I was a child when all the dogs ran loose, and we didn't have any behavior problems. We had a lot of dogs killed by cars. That was really bad, but we didn't have all the dog bites, and we didn't have vicious dog fights that end up with an animal going to the vet. We'd have dog fights, but they were skirmishes.
Well, one of them did end up in the vet. My dogs are both half Rottweiler, and the other dog was an American Bulldog.
Okay, you know, I'm sorry. I appreciate the call, but we are actually way over time now. So I'm going to have to say thanks so much for your call. And say thanks to Dr. Temple Grandin. And the new book is Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. And there are various websites that Dr. Grandin can sort of be found at, or more information, templegrandin.com and grandin.com. Dr. Grandin, thanks once again for joining us on Talking Animals. I really appreciate it.
All right, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for your time. Okay. I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. And it's time to proceed to name that animal tune. There'll be a prize. Tickets to the Old Crow Medicine Show tonight at Tampa Theater, along with Talese Brothers. What a great, great show. So, for the first person who calls in at 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune, it's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. All right, we have reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. I'll take any callers that might have the answer off the air. The program airs twice a month, specifically the first and second Wednesday of each month, so we'll return Wednesday, March 4th. I hope you'll join me then. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. We're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune, in this case by an artist who's performing in benefit for WMNF coming up. This is Loudon Wainwright III, who'll play for us at the Palladium Theater on February 25th with Animal Song on WMNF Tampa. We'll be right back.
chicken goes cluffing, his duck goes quack, and the rooster goes cock-a-doodle-doo. The pig is fat and the snail is slow, and the donkey sure is dumb. The lion is brave and the bear is strong, and the snake spits out its tongue. Yeah.